Good morning, such as it is. This is your Uncle Don with another program of joy and inspiration. A fine day to all of you out there in Prince George's chemical smog. Don't knock it, that's the smell of money. And cancer, too, is good for the economy. Keeps the doctors off the streets. This is CFUR, Canada's favorite university radio at 88.7 FM. Well, the United States got the terrorist attack that it needed on the 4th of July. The FBI, the Office of Homeland Security, and all of those government officials who had the citizens of the U.S. scared to death were vindicated. An Egyptian immigrant killed two people in the El Al terminal of Los Angeles International Airport. Pretty small potatoes for Los Angeles, where murder and mayhem are the rule, and not usually newsworthy. We would not have heard about the incident had it not happened at the time when it was needed, and if it had not involved an Israeli airline. Stay tuned for revelations from the U.S. authorities that the Egyptian shooter had, quote, ties to the Al-Qaeda. It will not take long to find or fabricate something. Now the Bush regime can carry on with its program of constricting freedoms at home with the consent of a terrorized population. From yesterday's Globe and Mail, there was a small editorial, which I can't resist reading, entitled The Poor Souls. Not even God can escape an economic downturn. The Vatican says it ran a $3 million U.S. deficit in 2001, its first shortfall in 9 years. The problem wasn't a lack of contributions to the collection plate. Indeed, those were up, possibly thanks to the flood of churchgoers after September 11th. No, the problem was the stock market. Like everyone else, the Roman Catholic Church got hammered in the slump. Given the powerful friends these guys have, one would hate to be the brokers who steered Rome to buy Enron or WorldCom. Then again, maybe those brokers have their own deals with the devil. Gotta love that one. If you've not lived in a large American city or some other place with constant violence, you may not understand how it can become banal. I moved to Oakland, California at the time when the Black Panthers were in ascendance and the black citizens were finally rebelling against the oppression of the Oakland police. It is not often that the full name of the party, known that the full name of the party was the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. At that time, the Oakland police had been recruiting their police from the Deep South through newspaper ads. They recruited large white racists as the answer to controlling the black community. The Panthers formed their party to defend their community. They exercised their constitutional right to bear arms by carrying rifles openly in the streets. The cops and the white establishment panicked at the sight of armed blacks, and the Panthers became the target of the local police, the FBI, and Nixon's COINTELPRO program of subversion, infiltration, dirty tricks, and outright attack. The Panthers were spreading beyond Oakland to organize the black populations of the major cities and were doing such subversive acts as providing free breakfast to the kids. This could not be allowed. The Oakland police pulled a raid on the headquarters of the Panthers and killed a number of their leaders. These police claimed that they were attacked by the Panthers, but a subsequent investigation found that all of the shots, and there were hundreds, had been fired into the building and there was no return fire. It was a massacre. The white establishment applauded. In 1968, Oakland, California was effectively segregated. There was a pleasant white area that spread out from the business district and up into the Berkeley Hills. The black ghetto spread inland and constituted a no-go area for white folks at night. There were areas where even the police would not visit except in overwhelming force. I found an old duplex on the border between these two areas. There was a strip between the white and black areas that was about a block wide and predominantly Chinese. This house had been condemned and then renovated very roughly to make it legal, and I paid the princely sum of $35 a month for it. My living room was on the second story, and from there I could see a part of the ghetto. One of my first nights there, I could hear a gunfight somewhere out in the ghetto. There was no mistaking the sound of shots being exchanged for several minutes. No sirens, nothing. The next day I bought a local paper to learn the details of the battle, and there was nothing. Every few days, I could hear gunfire from the ghetto, and soon I found that I ignored it. Gunfire there was just background noise. Around this time, the Oakland police purchased a couple of helicopters equipped with brilliant searchlights. They used these at night to augment ground troops when they were engaged in a chase. One night, one of them came over our neighborhood. The sound and brilliant light were terrifying. They used these helicopters for a few months before they gave up the idea and sold one of their toys. It seems that some irate citizen, never identified, shot down the other one. A clear case of direct action to a problem, American style. Good news for those of us who want to see the arrogance of Bush and the American Empire rewarded with humiliation. Looks like the empire may have hit the wall. It is too early to tell for sure, but there are signs that the eagle is landing, as it was put in the Financial Times. The American government, which was recently shouting that it was on the road to perpetual prosperity and power, is getting a comeuppance. For years, the U.S. has financed the gigantic current account deficit, that is, the difference between imports and exports, by importing foreign capital that has inflated the stock market, kept the Yankee dollar high, and allowed the American consumer to go on a prolonged buying spree. Now the dollar is falling. There is a net outflow of foreign investments, and the stock market is tumbling. Georgie's phony war on terrorism, Star Wars, and military adventures around the world are costing plenty, and the budget surplus that was supposed to be a sign of fiscal responsibility has evaporated. In fact, the U.S. Congress has just authorized an increase in the national debt by some $450 billion. The bloom on the American miracle is fading. With consumer, corporate, and government debts ballooning, how long will it be before we see a wave of bankruptcies that overwhelm the glory of the American dream? It is unfortunate that Trudeau's dream of a larger Canadian independence from the American economy was betrayed by both Mulroney and Chrétien. Now the Yanks take 80% of our exports, and we stand to sink as fast and as far as the States, if not more so, thanks to for betraying our country, Brian. May you choke on the fat salaries and perquisites that your corporate friends are showering on you. We can date the fall of the Soviet-style so-called communism to around 1990. What date do you suppose will be assigned by future historians to the fall of capitalism? There's a problem hidden in this question as stated. The Soviet Union never had communism as envisioned by Karl Marx. Their system has been characterized by some economists as state capitalism. Lenin took a popular revolution in a backward country and turned it into a totalitarian parody of a true socialist system. For decades, the Soviet Empire was run by a self-serving bureaucracy that paid scant attention to the needs of its citizens as consumers. The capitalist system, as it exists in North America at least, has characteristics of Lenin's Soviet Empire. It is likewise run by bureaucracies that overlap. The corporate bureaucracies that supposedly work for their shareholders are largely self-serving, as evidenced by recent scandals of the ripping off of corporate assets by managers to the tunes of billions of dollars in some cases. Then there are the government bureaucracies, headed by political masters who have one eye on their present perquisites and the other on future rewards in the boardrooms of the corporations. Look at past political leaders like Brian Mulroney, Glenn Clark, and even Bob Rae to find how they collect their rewards from the corporations for being good boys and following orders. While the Soviet system existed as an alternative model for third world countries, the capitalist countries had to make it look like capitalism was working for the average person over here. Unions raised wages, the welfare state covered those in most urgent need, and the standard of living was increasing for most citizens. Now our leaders do not have to worry about the loyalty of other countries to the capitalist model. It is all that is left. The enforcers of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the World Trade Organization make sure that all governments toe the line or suffer the consequences of being left out of the World Economic Party. Those who do not follow the model dictated to them are labeled as rogue states or an axis of evil that must be isolated, subverted, and ultimately destroyed. But we are told that capitalism is a great success. Look at the huge office towers in the city centers. Ignore the World Trade Center for the moment. Look at the vast suburbs with their monster houses and neat lawns. Look at the fat SUVs in the driveways. Look at the shopping centers. Wow, nice shiny stuff. Impressive to crows. Let's look behind the shine. Look at the growing numbers of homeless people living on the streets beneath those office towers. Look at the dysfunctional families in those monster houses and the debts they carry. Look at the pollution caused by the frantic consumption of crap by these families. See how we rip up the land to feed those huge vehicles. See the shopping centers filled with goods made by semi-slave labor at home and abroad. See the sales clerks struggling to survive on minimum wage part-time jobs. Something is wrong with this picture. While our neoconservative governments on both sides of the 49th parallel boast surpluses in budgets, now disappearing, beneath the streets the water system decays and the sewers leak. The water feeding those systems is becoming polluted and scarce. People who used to drink tap water as a matter of course now buy bottled water. Pollution is good for some businesses. Our schools are failing to educate our children. I recall the story from New York of the family who was suing the state because they found that their son could not read his own high school diploma. There was a double failure. The state failed to teach, and the parents were so incompetent in their parenting that they did not realize after 12 years of school that their son could not read. Where in hell were those parents? What is wrong with such a system that does not deal with problems like these? Our jails are filled with people who are functionally illiterate. Is it an unanswerable question as to how many of these would have run afoul of the law if they had been taught decent reading and other necessary skills? I can tell you one thing. It is a damn sight cheaper to teach a child life skills than to run an ignorant adult through the so-called justice system for 40 years. Calculate the cost of the jails, the courts, the probation apparatus, and the damage done to society by such a person, and I would reckon that $1 million a head is a conservative estimate. We are victims of short-term thinking in this society. Like skimping on a child's education, skimping on other social costs had long-run costs. Our politicians cannot look beyond the next election, but many of the decisions they make have impacts into the next century. For instance, it is easier and cheaper to patch a deteriorating street than to repave it, although the patches will be temporary and the repaving will be more urgent later. Other costs can be externalized, as economists say. That is, someone else will have to pay. Mike Harris saved money for the government of Ontario by closing water testing labs. He was not one of the ones to die in Walkerton. Campbell is saving money by closing hospitals. He will not be one of the ones to die on the way to a distant hospital because a nearby one has been demolished. Pity. This is where I'm going. By what standard do we judge the success of an economic and political system? Who are we to say that one system has failed while another has succeeded? Hitler achieved full employment in Germany. Does this make Nazism a success? Stalin had full employment also, and some of the achievements of the Soviet Union in the face of covert and overt hostility from the capitalist countries were truly remarkable. But we do not judge it to have been a success. There are reports, though, of a large percentage of the citizens of Russia who would return to the old Soviet system for all its warts, because it did fulfill many of the needs of the people, even while it fell short in the area of consumer goods. Is the United States a successful society? Do we ask a Wall Street broker or a prisoner on a Georgia chain gang? Here in British Columbia, we have a great environment, right? The license plates boast of a beautiful British Columbia. We have a slogan, Super Natural British Columbia. Forget it. We used to have a provincial ministry of environment. Some jokers in the Campbell government decided to abolish that and create a monster called, ironically, the Ministry of Water, Land, and Air Protection. Some protection we are getting. The minister, Joyce Murray, is quoted as having said, quote, without a healthy economy, we cannot have a healthy environment, unquote. My God, what a dumb thing for a minister of the crown to say. I suppose that before the white man invaded British Columbia, bringing his industry, there was not a healthy environment. She has it backwards. Without a healthy environment, there cannot be a healthy economy. With a sick environment, we will have a sick population and a sick society. That can never result in a healthy economy. The Mexican maquiladoras are ready examples of sick environments that have bred sick workers and a devastated economy. There's lots of money to be made there, but it is all spirited away, leaving the society naked and broke. Welcome to the brave new world of globalization. A friend used to work for the Ministry of Environment in a small town west of here. He said that he expected large changes and cuts from the government, but he was appalled by what he found. The new ministry, he said, had no plan and no clue as to what they were doing or what the ministry was all about. He had the integrity to quit. He said he could not work for idiots. If there were not for the fact that government workers are tied down with families, mortgages, and addictions to groceries, I doubt there would be anyone left to turn off the lights in most government offices. If you want an investment tip, here's a good one. Invest in companies selling bottled water. And keep an eye on companies selling bottled oxygen. Now it is time to dip into Uncle Don's mailbag to see what the fans have sent in the last week. From Mrs. A.W. on Ewart Street comes another letter with a familiar ring. Didn't I tell you last week what I thought of your letter? It goes double this week. And the horse you rode in on, lady. From Mrs. W.L. at Toad Hill comes an encouraging letter. Your spellbinding monologue is the high point of my week. I like that. Don't bother cooking my supper tonight, dear. I'm taking you out to dinner. From Mr. J.W. of Pineview comes this note. I want to thank you for the increase in property values in my neighborhood since prospective buyers have found that they are safely out of range of your programs. Inner city people are coming here to get their kids away from your evil influence. Well, Mr. J.R., I hope your kids don't have to take their guns to school anymore either. Goof. I think that covers a fair sampling of Uncle Don's mail for this week. More news about our beloved provincial government. According to a piece circulating on the internet, the government has been negotiating for the sale of BC Hydro since they took office. Likely bidders would be American power companies, which would tie us into the North American system in the same way as they are tied in California. If Hydro were to operate on a purely business basis, they would sell our power where they could get the best price. This would put us in a position with our electricity that we are in with our oil and gas. If we do not pay the same price or greater than California or some other buyer, we would not get the power. They already blackmail us with our own oil in that way, and it is guaranteed in NAFTA. This proposed sale would likely mean a tripling of our power costs and the flight of industries that use lots of power, therefore more unemployment, a smaller tax base, and an excuse for further government cutbacks as revenue shrinks. This would lead us further down the road to third world status. Another item on British Columbia's garage sale of Crown assets. The Coquihalla Highway is reported to be up for sale. If this came to pass, we could expect that the tolls would be raised to whatever the traffic, so to speak, would bear. This would leave anyone who refused to pay to drive the Fraser Canyon route a daunting trip at the best of times. And naturally, a company owning the Coquihalla Highway would object to any improvement of the Fraser Canyon route as an unfair intrusion into the profits of its private route. With the way we are tied into NAFTA and other sellout agreements, it just might work in the secret tribunals where our rights have been sacrificed. Keep an eye on this ball for further revelations after the decision has been made. Anecdote time. In university, I had a roommate for a year whose proudest achievement until that time was when he had been a youth delegate to the Republican Convention in 1964 on behalf of Barry Goldwater. Now, Barry Goldwater was ahead of his time that he wanted to virtually abolish government. He even advocated selling off the army and contracting out wars. My roommate hated government at all levels and saw nothing but good in the capitalist economy. He went on to graduate and then acquire an MBA from the Wharton School. He worked on Wall Street making outrageous amounts of money and spent it as fast as it came in. One day in the early 90s, he was downsized. That means fired, folks. He thought his talents were rare and valuable, but he found that he could be replaced by some young hotshot who would work for half his salary. Since then, he has been working on a few short-term contracts with long periods of unemployment in between. The joke on him has been a couple of those contracts have been with the U.S. Treasury. They sent him to Lithuania to be a consultant for their dismantling of their welfare state. I guess it was a good choice for the U.S., but it put him in a position of being fed by the hand he had bitten for decades. I love to watch him squirm. The last job I know of he applied for was with the government of Vietnam. He even flew to Hanoi for a job interview. The irony of seeing him grovel for a job there after the battles we had over the Vietnam War while roommates was not lost on me. So there I was, implying that our system is a failure. What would be a fair scorecard to judge when a system is a success? First of all, a successful system, in my estimation, would be one that feeds all of its people. What system is a success by this criterion? As far as I know, the best job being done is in those societies that are the most egalitarian, namely the Scandinavian countries. The worst job is done in the poorest countries, countries at war, totalitarian dictatorships, and those with the widest spread of wealth. As our very own Jean Chrétien recently pointed up in his expensive Kananaskis party, lots of these countries are in Africa. He could have cast an eye toward home as Canada, with its vast agricultural surpluses, does a miserable job, as evidenced by the proliferation of food banks. A successful system would also have an education establishment that allowed every citizen to achieve the highest level of which he or she is able without reference to family economic circumstances. We fail there. We cannot even put all of our children through primary school, and higher education is becoming largely out of reach for all but the upper middle class. The best job is being done by the likes of Cuba. There is a country that has been at war with the most powerful country in the world for 4 decades, yet which has managed to outperform that superpower in the area of educating its people. Cuba does not crank out the MBAs from any Harvard, but it has neighborhood schools everywhere, and all children must go to these schools. While British Columbia, a land of sparse population and immense wealth, is closing schools, Cuba has not closed a single school since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the loss of Soviet support. The Cuban economy took a terrible hit in 1990, but they kept up their health and education systems. Come to think of it, isn't that what Liar Campbell promised us? Job time on Uncle Don's notorious show. The following are postings from our bulletin board here in the spacious studios of CFUR, Canada's favorite university radio at 88.7 FM. Wanted, freedom fighters for Uncle Sam's Homeland Security Department. This position offers good wages, travel, and opportunities for advancement, killing, looting, torture, and selective rape in the interest of advancing freedom in the world. Contact Oliver North, the Pentagon, Washington, D.C., USA. Wanted, filers. A large international organization with a long history of transnational operations seeks male employees willing to work one day per week, wear funny clothes, and locate anywhere in the world. Sky is literally the limit for advancement. Funny hats supplied. Contact the Vatican. Oh, wait a minute. Uncle Don made an error. That is not files, but pedophiles. I apologize for any inconvenience. Wanted, associates for new Walmart store in Prince George. Please note that Walmart has no employees, just associates. Applicants must be willing to declare a total lack of work experience to qualify for 500 hours of split shift part-time work at $6 an hour before being fired. Contact the Prince George Chamber of Commerce. That concludes our job postings for Tuesday, 9 July, 2002. We've been told that old age brings wisdom. Don't believe it. Old age does give us background and experience that provides us with a platform for making better decisions. I used to be adamant in my opinions. Now I am still adamant about some things, like George Bush being a wicked man and Kissinger being a war criminal, but I have mellowed in most issues. By the way, I have to say wicked since Georgie has appropriated the word evil to be used on anyone he does not like. I find that people are upset with what they see as my anti-Americanism. I should be glad to have our benefactor next door looking after our welfare and our defense from all of those nasty people out there. When I came here, I considered myself as a sort of refugee. When I say this, I do not mean to belittle those who have come to Canada for fear of their lives and after severe privations. I was able to leave the States comfortably without fear, and I drove. I came in a Volkswagen Bug that carried all of my worldly goods and bore a bumper sticker that I had found obnoxious in the States, but that I found fitting for my trip. It read, America, love it or leave it. I voted with my feet, so to speak. My arrival was not like landing on a deserted shore in a leaky boat, only to be put into a prison. This is the way we now treat desperate immigrants. But then I am a white and I had a job offer. A defector from the Soviet Union was expected to be anti-communist. A defector from the United States is expected to come here wrapped in the stars and stripes. There are too many of that type of American immigrant. I am not one. When I came to Canada, the Vietnam War was raging and Trudeau had thrown the doors open to American defectors. I met men in Toronto who had literally run across the border with FBI agents on their heels. Canada at that time was a very different place from what it is now. One of the sources of my bitterness is the way Canada has veered toward becoming an American satellite. Brian Mulroney sold us out. Chrétien is continuing the process. The free trade agreement was a nail in the coffin. Now they are talking of adopting the American dollar as our currency. Anyone who advocates that now is either ignorant of what has been done to Argentina or advocates the merging of Canada into the United States. Is treason still illegal? At one time, I was adamant in my opinion that a person was a fool to buy a house in Canada. In the States, there is an incentive to borrow to buy a house, as mortgage interest there is tax deductible. Here, the only tax incentive is the exemption from capital gains tax on a principal residence. I have seen too many people buy into a house only to find out that the Hell's Angels move in next door, or that property values drop, leaving them holding the bag. As a renter, when the angels moved in, or when an opportunity to relocate came along, I was free to give a month's notice and be gone. No real estate anchor adorned my butt. Then I rented my current home. Lots of land, log house overlooking a lake on a nature reserve. This is the first place I ever wanted to own, and when the opportunity to buy came along, my wife and I grabbed it. No longer do I speak so vociferously against home ownership. Ah, yes, I mentioned the word wife. Up until about 20 years ago, I was also adamant in my opposition to the ties of marriage. I professed that the bonds of voluntary relationships should not be cursed with any government or religious involvement. Then I found a woman with whom I wanted to spend the rest of my days. We married quietly, then I had to face my friends and acquaintances who spared me no slack in rubbing my nose in my hypocrisy. One earlier example of having to dine on crow happened in California. There I had decided that I could get along with almost any kind of person except Southerners. I also expressed a general aversion to redheads. My experiences with Southern crackers in the military still grated on me, and I don't know where I got the aversion to redheads, but the inevitable happened. At a party, I met and ended up living with a redhead from, God help me, Mississippi. What can I say? I was ridiculed and pilloried as I deserved. My parents lived a continent away, so I was safe from their scrutiny. I think they were pleased with my new partner, even if we were living in sin. That was because I only told them the parts of the story that would please them. Ours was a rather typical California love story. Boy meets girl next door, falls in love, girls moves in with boy, and so on. Like most California stories, it had a twist. My new love did indeed live next door before moving in with me. However, she had been living next door with her husband. Husband did not mind, as he used the opportunity to fill the vacancy with a girlfriend. Ah, California. This is CFUR, Canada's favorite university radio, at 88.7 FM. Hey, big party coming up this month. The Pope is coming to Toronto for a grand celebration of World Youth Day. At a time when more children in Canada and around the world are suffering from hunger and homelessness than ever before, the Mother Church has declared it is party time! The Magic Kingdom of the Vatican will be bringing over 123 rare art treasures for exhibition that are valued at some $800 million. Of course, the Vatican will not be selling any of these treasures to pay the expenses of this traveling circus. They are pleading poverty, leaving the good citizens of Canada pay an estimated $6.9 million for security, garbage collection, and incidentals. Nor will they pay any of the victims of abuse by priests and brothers over the years by selling any of their gaudy junk. No, the church is poor. The truly poor and street people will be hauled out of sight so as not to offend the dignity of the man who heads an organization founded by a poor carpenter. This vast organization has adopted the trappings of the Romans, who allegedly persecuted and crucified that carpenter. Way to go! Just in time for this grand party, we see a bizarre mixture of the modern and the medieval. It seems that there is an internet petition pleading for the canonization of an Indian maiden, who would now be called a First Nations woman, but no matter, called Lily of the Mohawks, by those who cannot pronounce her real name. She was born in 1656 and died at the age of 24. She allegedly lost all of her near kin at the age of 4 to smallpox, and she herself was scarred and her eyesight dimmed. A cynic might conclude that her thinking was also clouded, and perhaps she was embarrassed by her disfigurement, but not me. Anyway, she headed for the boondocks and preached Jesus until she died. Her biographer was quoted in the Globe and Mail of 2 July as having written, quote, "She was an enigma because she was so spiritually advanced despite having lived in the wilderness," unquote. Wow. The assumption here is that one can only be spiritually advanced if one lives in a city. After this show, I think I'll go down to George Street and charge my spiritual batteries. This biographer also states that there were so many miracles that they didn't even bother to authenticate them. Right. This biographer lives in Las Vegas. Might I speculate that she spends her spare time in Roswell chasing flying saucers? Now we have a whole crew of grown men, it has to be men to be credible, sifting a sparse history to find evidence of miracles that can be attributed to Lily of the Mohawks. Without a trace of irony, a priest who reports to the Vatican is quoted as saying, quote, "Right now, I'm hoping for a person from Michigan whose kidneys failed, was on dialysis, and now she's not. I'm still waiting for the paperwork," unquote. Ah, the inevitable paperwork. The real miracle that the Vatican is hoping for is a First Nation saint to take the heat off of them for the centuries of crimes against the native people since their boy Cristobal Colon landed in the New World in 1492. Maybe if the First Nations people have one of their own to pray to, they will forget asking for compensation from the poverty-stricken church. Is this still the 21st century? Has a man walked on the moon? Our technology has advanced far beyond the evolution of our minds. We can fly in space, but we still think like cavemen, cowering from thunder and praying to sky gods. When I was a soldier stationed near Panama City, I used to be appalled by the poverty of the average people and the opulence of the churches. I've seen people I knew pay 50 cents for a candle in a church when they had nothing to feed their children, and the priests who aided and abetted this travesty were all fat and healthy. There was a church there called the Church of the Golden Altar, which actually had an altar made of gold. The story was that when the pirate Henry Morgan raided Panama City, the priest whitewashed the altar to save it from being stolen. People are starving today virtually in the shadow of this treasure. Draw your own conclusions. Here in Prince George, the same impoverished church has yielded land for what will soon be the site of a Walmart, another organization of predators. I wonder how much money changed hands for this land and whether any of the proceeds will be used to pay for the Pope's party or, God forbid, so to speak, pay the victims of the church's residential schools and predatory priests. Fat chance. Have I offended you yet? Send irate letters, no white powder, please, to Uncle Don, care of CFUR, 3333 University Way, Prince George, V2N4Z9. All letters will be subject to editing and ridicule by yours truly. Beware. This is CFUR 88.7 in Prince George. We were promised a new era of prosperity for British Columbia under Gordon Campbell. In spite of the firings and spending cuts, there are opportunities out there. For instance, there are going to be a good number of large buildings available that could be used for bingo halls. Since we have collectively chosen that it is more important to warehouse children than to educate them, these former school buildings can serve the dual purpose of entertaining the unemployed and ignorant while squeezing their rent money from their grasp. There are entrepreneurs out there, like the good fellow who owns our very own casino and a couple of bingo halls in Prince George, who need an outlet to invest their gambling revenue. And, of course, there are the, quote, charities, like, for instance, the hockey teams of middle-class kids, who else can afford the equipment, that should be supported by the desperate poor's gambling. I should not knock gambling, as is one of the bright spots in our economy. Just think, a whole society that exists by selling lottery tickets and bingo cards to one another. No more dirty jobs in the forests or mines, just nice, clean necktie-type work for the future. We are surrounded by billboards that inform us of the easy riches to be gained by investing in a lottery ticket. There are easy riches out there in gambling, don't get me wrong. Jim Pattison, for one, makes a fortune renting out his billboard space to the lottery corporation. TELUS makes big money on the phone lines connecting lottery terminals to the central computer. Computer makers profit from all the hardware and all these little kiosks that infest the shopping malls. Merchants make a cut from selling tickets and keeps them from having to sell real goods and services. I buy my gas at the superstore. It's the only place where I can get a real discount on the gasoline that our vehicles turn into pollution and travel. Invariably, I find myself queued up behind people gambling and buying psychoactive, addictive drugs in the form of tobacco. I wonder when they will just give up the charade of pushing gasoline and concentrate on their gambling and drugs, which are more profitable and less messy. I was first aware of something called dry grad when a co-worker sold me a discount coupon for a Boston pizza to help me finance a dry grad some years ago. I took the coupon to Boston Pizza, and we would not honor it. Since then, I have given some thought to the idea of dry grad with a bit of chip on my shoulder. When I graduated from high school 100 years ago, it was expected that this was an occasion to be celebrated. In those days, celebration equaled drunkenness, and we all got drunk. Since then, social values as relate to alcohol have matured, and being drunk lost its aura of harmless fun. But we live in a world where alcohol is becoming increasingly available, where alcoholic beverages masquerade as pop, and where drinking is being aggressively portrayed in advertising as patriotic. A young person who does not understand the allure and dangers of alcohol is ripe for some rough times. A drunken debauch in celebration of graduation is not necessarily dangerous. What is dangerous is behavior that can go with drunkenness. Drinking driving is no longer acceptable, and fights can get very serious behind alcohol. So why not provide a safe environment where the kids can drink and go nuts under supervision and with rides home provided? There's more to be learned from a nasty hangover than from all of the preachings of so-called do-gooders who try to keep the kids away from booze. If they really want to organize a celebration without alcohol, maybe the answer is not a dry grad, but a high grad. Those parents who strong-arm friends and co-workers into buying raffle tickets might be better employed rolling joints for their kids. The cost of the pot could easily be recouped by selling munchies to their stoned offspring at controlled events. They would still have to provide transportation after the affair, but at least they would not have carloads of aggressive, barfing teenagers to deal with. I would be much more comfortable knowing that the kids are mellowing out and toking up than worrying about being accosted by some drunken lout on the street. Let's loosen up and get rid of these marijuana laws that are rammed down our throats by a bunch of self-righteous legislators who are afraid that someone was having more fun than them. Well, this is Uncle Don now, signing off for the week.